Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is. Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories related to politics in both India and Burundi. First, India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, have created a coalition government to rule Kashmir state. It is the first time the BJP has had a part in governing India's only Muslim-majority area. Christopher Cruz has more.
I will uphold the sovereignty and integrity of India.
The swearing-in of the new government took place in the state's winter capital, Jammu. Mufti Mohammed Saeed of the People's Democratic Party took the oath as Kashmir's chief minister. Nirmal Singh from the Bharatiya Janata Party was sworn in as his deputy. Prime Minister Narendra Modi attended the historic ceremony to watch a member of his party become, for the first time, one of the state's top governing officials. Until now, the BJP has not had much political power in Jammu and Kashmir. India and Pakistan have had a long dispute about which country the area belongs to. Anti-India feelings are strong in the state. The two parties negotiated for weeks to build an alliance after mixed results in November elections. The PDP won in the Muslim-majority Kashmir Valley. The BJP received huge support in the Hindu-majority Jammu area. The two parties have settled some differences, but they agreed to disagree on their more complex differences. Chief Minister Saeed described it as the coming together of the North Pole and the South Pole. Satish Misra is a researcher at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi. She says the alliance between the two parties could help Kashmir become integrated with the rest of the country. She says the BJP will have to become more moderate in its political positions if it is to grow its influence in the Kashmir Valley. The BJP eased its opposition to a constitutional measure that would give Kashmir self-rule. The PDP eased its demand to cancel a very unpopular law that gives Indian soldiers wide powers to search and shoot people in the state. The new government says its top goal will be the state's development, but political observers say there is skepticism in Kashmir Valley about the BJP having a part in governing the state. Noor Ahmad Baba is a political science professor at Kashmir University. He says the skepticism is combined with hope. He says people believe the political alliance might speed up development of the mountainous area and its recovery from floods last year that caused severe damage. Soon after taking office, the new chief minister said peace was a condition for the state's development. He said he supports talks with Kashmiri separatists and a peace process with Pakistan.
We want to make this alliance a turning point in trying to meet hearts and minds of people.
Some observers say the fact that the BJP is now part of the governing coalition in Kashmir could mean there will be talks between the central government and Kashmiri separatists. Prime Minister Modi's government has opposed such efforts. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Burundi is facing unrest before its presidential election in June. People are questioning the right of President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek a third term. Mr. Nkurunziza has led the country since 2005. Kelly Jean Kelly reports.
Advisors, political observers, and Burundi's opposition party all say the president plans to seek re-election. The move is disputed because the Constitution limits a president to 2 5-year terms. Mr. Nkurunziza was first elected to the presidency in 2005. His election was the result of a National Assembly vote, not a popular election. At the time, he was the only presidential candidate. In 2010, voters elected Mr. Nkurunziza to a second term after the opposition candidate left the race. Now, some observers say it may not be illegal for the president to seek a third term, but they say it might not be the right thing to do. John Manirakiza is from Burundi. He says no one should be able to serve for more than 10 years, whether or not the Constitution allows a third term. He notes that the country is still arguing about a presidential candidate only 3 months before the election. That fact, he says, shows the country's politics are dysfunctional or unhealthy. Agathon Rwasa is the leading opposition candidate. He agrees Burundi's political situation is bad and may be getting worse. Recently, media reported large demonstrations in the country's capital. Isidore Interampiba is with the Burundian embassy to the United States. He points out that President Nkurunziza did not choose to run in 2005. Instead, his party appointed him. And, Mr. Interambiba says, the president's party has not yet named a candidate for the 2015 election. The United Nations Security Council has commented on the situation. In a statement released last month, council members called for a free, fair, and peaceful election process. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. An open letter to Iran by 47 Republican members of the United States Senate, released Monday, started a heated debate this week. The question was, who controls foreign policy, Congress or the President? The letter warned Iran that any deal over its disputed nuclear program with the Obama administration could be overturned. It said that the next U.S. president could revoke such an executive agreement, and future Congresses could modify the terms of the agreement at any time. Without congressional approval, the letter said, the agreement would be only an executive agreement. Lawmakers signing the letter included all but seven of the Republican Party's 54-member majority in the U.S. Senate. They noted that President Barack Obama was leaving office in less than 2 years, as required by the Constitution. Many of them, they said, might still be in office for many years. Historically, presidents and Congress have argued over their constitutional powers to control foreign policy. Thomas Fleming is a historian who writes about American history. He says America's first president had a strong opinion on the responsibility of the executive branch in foreign policy.
Washington's presidency was the strong president personified. He was barely in the chair of the presidency more than a few days, and he wrote a letter to all the nations of Europe saying, if you want to communicate with the United States of America, write a letter to me, George Washington, not to the Congress.
President Obama criticized the letter to Iran on Monday. A spokesman for the president, Josh Earnest, told reporters the letter was an attempt to slow down the sensitive negotiations. The U.S. and five other world powers are trying to reach a basic agreement with Iran. The goal is to persuade Iran to give up its program to develop nuclear weapons in return for easing of international sanctions. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky was one of the lawmakers to sign the letter. He defended it, saying he did not know why the administration wanted to keep Congress out of the emerging deal with Iran. He said it was clear that the president did not want Congress to have a part in a deal that could have a big effect on U.S. national security. The letter brought strong reactions from former and current diplomatic officials. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said on Wednesday that the letter left him in disbelief.
This risks undermining the confidence that foreign governments in thousands of important agreements commit to between the United States and other countries. And it purports to tell the world that if you want to have any confidence in your dealings with America, they have to negotiate with 535 members of Congress.
Not all Republican senators agreed with the letter. Senator Susan Collins of Maine told VOA that she did not think the letter was the right thing to do. Iranian officials also responded to the letter. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said the move showed disintegration in U.S. politics. Iranian foreign minister and chief negotiator Mohammad Javad Zarif dismissed the letter, saying it was of no legal value. Talks are set to restart on Sunday. Negotiators are seeking to complete the basic deal by the end of March, with final agreement by the end of June. Whether or not the U.S. can reach a nuclear agreement with Iran, one thing is clear. The U.S. Constitution states that the President of the United States shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Open Boat. It was written by Stephen Crane and is based on what really happened to him in 1896. Crane was traveling from the United States to Cuba as a newspaper reporter. One night, his ship hit a sandbar. It sank in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida. Most of the people on board got into lifeboats. Crane was among the last to leave. There were three others with him, the ship's captain, the cook, and a sailor. These four men climbed into the only remaining lifeboat. The boat was so small that no one believed it could stay afloat for very long. None of the four men thought he would ever reach the shore. But the men fought the rough seas bravely with all their strength. Would they finally reach land? Here is Shep O'Neill with the first part of the story.
The small lifeboat bounced from wave to wave in the rough seas of the Atlantic. The four men in the boat could not see the sky. The waves rose too high. The waves, with their white tops, pushed at the open boat with angry violence. Every man thought each wave would be his last. Surely the boat would sink, and he would drown. The man thought that most adults would need a bathtub larger than the boat they were sailing. The waves were huge, and each created a problem in guiding the direction of the boat. For 2 days since the ship sank, the four men had been struggling to reach land. But there was no land to be seen. All the men saw were violent waves, which rose and came fiercely down on them. The men sat in the boat, wondering if there was any hope for them. The ship's cook sat in the bottom of the boat. He kept looking at the 15 centimeters which separated him from the ocean. The boat had only 2 wooden oars. They were so thin, it seemed as if they would break against the waves. The sailor, named Billy, directed the boat's movement with 1 of the oars. The newspaper reporter pulled the 2nd oar. He wondered why he was there in the boat. The 4th man was the captain of the ship that had sunk. He lay in the front of the small boat. His arm and leg were hurt when the ship sank. The captain's face was sad. He had lost his ship and many of his sailors. But he looked carefully ahead, and he told Billy when to turn the boat. "Keep her a little more south, Billy," he said. "A little more south, sir," the sailor repeated. Sitting in the boat was like sitting on a wild horse. As each wave came, the boat rose and fell, like a horse starting toward a fence too high to jump. The problem was that after successfully floating over 1 wave, you find that there is another one behind it, just as strong and ready to flood your boat. As each wall of water came in, it hid everything else that the men could see. The waves came in silence. Only their white tops made threatening noises. In the weak light, the faces of the men must have looked gray. Their eyes must have shone in strange ways as they looked out at the sea. The sun rose slowly into the sky. The men knew it was the middle of the day because the color of the sea changed from slate gray to emerald green with gold lights, and the white foam on the waves looked like falling snow. As the lifeboat bounced from the top of each wave, the wind tore through the hair of the men. As the boat dropped down again, the water fell just past them. The top of each wave was a hill from which the men could see, for a brief period, a wide area of shining sea. The cook said the men were lucky because the wind was blowing toward the shore. If it started blowing the other way, they would never reach land. The reporter and the sailor agreed, but the captain laughed in a way that expressed humor and tragedy all in one. He asked, "Do you think we've got much of a chance now, boys?" This made the others stop talking. To express any hope at this time, they felt to be childish and stupid. But they also did not want to suggest there was no hope, so they were silent. "Oh, well," said the captain, "we'll get ashore all right." But there was something in his voice that made them think, as the sailor said, "Yes, if this wind holds." Seagulls flew near and far. Sometimes the birds sat down on the sea in groups near brown seaweed that rolled on the waves. The anger of the sea was no more to them than it was to a group of chickens 1,000 miles away on land. Often the seagulls came very close and stared at the men with black bead-like eyes. The man shouted angrily at them, telling them to be gone. The sailor and the reporter kept rowing with the thin wooden oars. Sometimes they sat together, each using an oar. Sometimes one would pull on both oars while the other rested. Brown pieces of seaweed appeared from time to time. They were like islands, bits of earth that did not move. They showed the men in the boat that it was slowly making progress toward land. Passed. Then, as the boat was carried to the top of a great wave, the captain looked across the water. He said that he saw the lighthouse at Mosquito Inlet. The cook also said he saw it. The reporter searched the western sky. "See it?" said the captain. "No," said the reporter slowly. "I don't see anything." "Look again," said the captain. He pointed. "It's exactly in that direction." This time, the reporter saw a small thing on the edge of the moving horizon. It was exactly like the point of a pin. "Think we'll make it, Captain?" he asked. "If this wind holds and the boat doesn't flood, we can't do much else," said the captain. ¶¶ would be difficult to describe the brotherhood of men that was here established on the sea. Each man felt it warmed him. They were a captain, a sailor, a cook, and a reporter. And they were friends. The reporter knew even at the time that this friendship was the best experience of his life. All obeyed the captain. He was a good leader. He always spoke in a low voice and calmly. "I wish we had a sail," he said, "to give you two boys a chance to rest." So they used his coat and one of the oars to make a sail, and the boat moved much more quickly. The lighthouse had been slowly growing larger. At last, from the top of each wave, the men in the boat could see land. Slowly, the land seemed to rise from the sea. Soon, the men could see two lines, one black and one white. They knew that the black line was formed by trees, and the white line was the sand. At last, the captain saw a house on the shore, and the lighthouse became even larger. "The keeper of the lighthouse should be able to see us now," said the captain. "He'll notify the life-saving people." Slowly and beautifully, the land rose from the sea. The wind came again. Finally, the men heard a new sound, the sound of waves breaking and crashing on the shore. "We'll never be able to make the lighthouse now," said the captain. "Swing her head a little more north, Billy."
"A little more north, sir," said the sailor.
The men watched the shore grow larger. They became hopeful. In an hour, perhaps, they would be on land. The men struggled to keep the boat from turning over. They were used to balancing in the boat. Now they rowed this wild horse of a boat like circus men. The water poured over them. The reporter thought he was now wet to the skin, but he felt in the top pocket of his coat and found 8 cigars. 4 were wet, but 4 were still dry. One of the men found some dry matches. Each man lit a cigar. The 4 men sailed in their boat with the belief of a rescue shining in their eyes. They smoked their big cigars and took a drink of water.
You have been listening to the first part of the American short story, The Open Boat, by Stephen Crane. This program was adapted for Special English by Shelley Gollist and produced by LaJuan Davis. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. Join us again next week when we tell you the second and last part of the story. You can read and listen to other American stories on our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Barbara Klein.